Hello, you're listening to Wait, How Do You Spell That? A Rare Disease Podcast. My name is Colby, and I'm the editor here at Patient Worthy. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. We really appreciate it. And today we're going to be discussing genetic therapies. There are more than 10,000 rare diseases, over 80% of which are genetic in nature. Gene therapies are an exciting and growing category of treatment, which holds a lot of promise for rare disease patients. However, as a relatively new class of treatment, progress in this area is sometimes slowed by factors such as cost of development, uncertainty in manufacturing, and regulatory issues. And I'm happy to say that to help in our discussion today, we have three very special guests. Dr. Julie Gerberding is the president and CEO of the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health, also known as the FNIH. That's an organization that helps to connect the National Institutes of Health with private entities such as life science companies, academic research institutions, and regulatory bodies. Also joining us on the show today is Dr. Courtney Silverthorne, the Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Innovation at the FNIH. And finally, we're also joined by Sharon King, a patient advocate and co-founder of Taylor's Tale, a rare disease advocacy organization. Drs. Gerberding and Silverthorne, Sharon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to join us today. And to start with, Dr. Gerberding, would you mind giving us an overview of the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health? What is its relation to the NIH and what are its goals?
Thank you so much for having us on the program. Let me just put it in a soundbite. The FNIH is really all about building bridges to breakthroughs. We connect the scientists at the NIH and their incredible tools and resources with their counterparts in life science companies, in academic organizations, as well as in foundations and patient research organizations. In a pre-competitive space, we build partnerships that help accelerate the identification of new opportunities for medicines and therapies, but also we build the data and the science infrastructure that helps other investigators benefit from that collaboration.
See, so a very important mission. Okay, well, the FNIH has a program called the Bespoke Gene Therapy Consortium, also known as the BGTC. Dr. Silverthorne, can you tell us more about this partnership and about the exciting news that you have for us today?
Yes. So the Bespoke Gene Therapy Consortium, or the BGTC, is one of the largest public-private partnerships that the FNIH currently manages. It's made up of 33 public and private sector partners. So we have participation across 11 different NIH institutes and centers. We have advisory participation from the US FDA. And we have over a 24 private sector partners, both for-profit organizations, large pharmaceutical companies, small biotechs, as well as nonprofit and patient advocacy organizations, both large and small, broad-based or very focused on a singular disease. The consortium launched in 2021, and over the last 2 years, we have been working on making research awards to advance some of the science around gene therapy, developing the selection of our clinical portfolio, and most recently, putting out the first version of the BGTC regulatory playbook. This is the first big deliverable that the consortium has made publicly available, and it's intended to be a resource for developers of gene therapies for rare diseases. These could be small companies and startups, clinician researchers who are working with patient groups, family foundations that are working within a patient community, and bringing together in sort of a one-stop shop way the resources and information that are necessary to move a gene therapy out of the laboratory and into a clinical trial.
That's really exciting news. And the BGTC regulatory playbook, it applies specifically to a type of gene therapy called adeno-associated virus gene therapies. Can you expand on this type of therapy and talk about some of the ways it's being investigated to help rare disease patients?
Yes. So most of the rare diseases are what are known as monogenetic, or they're caused by a single gene that is damaged or not functioning correctly. And AAV gene therapy is an excellent way to target specific genes by providing replacement copies. So if a gene is damaged or not functioning, it's not producing the proteins that are necessary for that particular function, we can treat a patient with AAV gene therapy, provide replacement copies of those genes that can then step in and fulfill the function of the damaged gene. And so there is a wealth of possibility of thousands and thousands of diseases that could be treated by AAV gene therapy. The challenge is that for these rare disease communities, some of the patient populations are extraordinarily small. In the United States, the definition of a rare disease is 200,000 patients or less. And on the high end of that scale, commercial pharmaceutical companies can step in and fulfill the needs of those patient populations. But for patient populations that are 50 or 10 or 2 patients in the United States, there just really isn't a business model that works for those patients. And so we are trying to provide the resources, the protocols, the regulatory documentation and templates that others can use to meet the needs of those very small patient populations.
Yes. And so Dr. Gerberding and Dr. Silverthorne, let's open up the question to both of you. What are some of the issues slowing down the pace of gene therapy development, and how specifically does the BGTC regulatory playbook help to address them?
Well, I'll start with the bigger picture issues, which are scientific. Even though we know that many of these illnesses are caused by single gene mutations, they may occur in organs that are hard to reach with gene therapy, or they may need to have repeated exposure to the gene modification technology. And sometimes that's problematic because these therapies can elicit immune response and therefore can't be repeated. So there are many such technical issues that still have to be solved from a scientific perspective. But even if we are able to find solutions to those very real and very challenging technical issues for some of these diseases, we have the market failure challenge that Courtney just referred to. And that really is that it's expensive no matter how much we can standardize or create platforms to accomplish these tasks. And we have to figure out how can we do this in such a way where a little company who's trying to solve a rare disease problem can afford to invest, and that the investors will have confidence that we know the regulatory pathway, both for the manufacturing, which hopefully could be something that could operate more on a platform basis and wouldn't have to have that wheel invented every time we turn to a new disease, but also at the other end. I mean, our standard for approving medicines in the United States usually requires what we call randomized phase 3 clinical trials, where you compare the new therapy against the standard of care. And when you're dealing with such rare diseases, it's almost impossible to use that model. It, for one thing, you don't have enough patients to meet the statistical requirements. But for another thing, for many rare diseases, you wouldn't want the control group. If you have something that looks promising, you want to be able to make it available for people who are otherwise facing a devastating illness. So we need to get a regulatory pathway that is, I don't want to say generic, because that isn't really the accurate way to think about it, but a regulatory pathway that's predictable, so that if someone's looking at an opportunity, they have confidence that they know what's necessary to get it manufactured, and they can do that in a cost-effective way, and they know what's necessary at the other end to get the product approved and available to patients, and they can have confidence that that will all work, and they're not inventing that wheel each time. So some of the expense and the obstacles to success will be removed. And that's really what the playbook and the future playbooks will hopefully address.
Yeah, absolutely. This first version of the playbook has really been a compilation of existing resources, subject matter expertise, FDA regulatory guidance, as well as some of the experts within the BGTC bringing their vast amount of expertise and knowledge in how to think about running a very small clinical trial for these rare disease communities, how to approach the regulatory pathway. And so we've compiled all of that information together, information about the different steps within the regulatory process, different types of meetings that you would have with the FDA throughout that process, information about some of the specific designations that are available for rare disease therapies, like the orphan drug designation, accelerated approvals designations, as well as some of the thought process around designing the clinical trials for these small patient populations? How do you think about the statistics? How do you think about what your comparator is when you can't assemble, you know, a standard of care comparable group? We want to build this out to be an even more robust resource for the patient communities and the researchers and clinicians that work with them. And that's why we went through a very rigorous 18-month process to select a portfolio of 8 rare diseases that could be treated by AAV gene therapy. And these are really a proof of concept that different parts of the preclinical and regulatory process can be repeated. And so within our clinical portfolio, we have diseases that are of an ocular nature, so that affect the eye, diseases that are neurological, and then diseases that we refer to as systemic, meaning that they can affect throughout the entire body. The portfolio also includes a number of different AAV types. These are called serotypes, thinking about different packaging outsides of the gene that you're carrying. And it also includes different routes of administration. And so within that clinical portfolio, we are standardizing as much as possible from indication to indication and clinical trial to clinical trial. All of our manufactured AAV vector will be tested through the same set of critical quality attributes. So these are things that you test on your manufactured product to quantify how much virus is in a particular dose. Is it sterile? Is it free from other contaminants, pH levels, things like that? And so we've assembled what we hope will be a minimum set of critical quality attributes, or CQAs, that we will propose to the FDA that can be repeated across all 8 indications. In the preclinical testing space, we have prepared standardized testing protocols on the basis of routes of administration. So for all of your ocular diseases, what types of animal models are most appropriate? How many animals do you need to test in order to show that something is safe and effective? What types of information need to be included in your application versus could be included in supplementary material that's provided to the FDA? And then creating the regulatory templates that are very standardized, that have the same information in the same sections, same formats, so that it's very easy to follow along, prepare exactly what's necessary, not submit information that isn't necessary, or maybe you might have to go back and repeat because it wasn't done in a particular fashion, and really provide the most streamlined pathway to safely move something from your testing into animal testing into your first in human clinical trial. The BGTC is also very focused on improving some of the biology of AAV and how we manufacture that AAV vector and how we deliver it to a patient. So in addition to the clinical portfolio and all of the work that's associated with that, we also have a portfolio of research awards. And these are scientists who are looking at ways to improve vector generation processes, which could make manufacturing easier to scale, as well as how we can improve the gene expression in a patient. Right now, AAV gene therapy requires very high doses, anywhere from 10 to the 12th, all the way up to 10 to the 15th vectors. So enormous amounts of virus, which can be challenging to manufacture, as well as potentially could have some safety effects that you want to be aware of, particularly at those very high doses. And so if we can make the AAV delivery more effective, we could potentially achieve the same therapeutic level of that gene expression with a lower dose to the patient. And this could improve safety, as well as potentially also improving the manufacturing, because you can get more doses out of a particular manufacturing batch and be able to reach more patients at the same cost.
Sounds like a very complex issue, and you know, one that certainly needs a playbook to try to get everybody on the same page. So that's quite an undertaking. Thank you. Let's talk about one particular aspect of this process of getting these therapies approved. So, and that's the importance of the patient perspective as part of this partnership and looking to streamline these efforts. Dr. Gerberding, can you expand on why that's so important in this process?
I would love to have a magic wand and go back in time and have the patient perspective included in all of the work that I've done in medicine from the very beginning. Because once you begin to introduce people who actually are living the experience themselves or caring for someone who's living the experience, your whole perspective changes. You begin to really appreciate from the patient's perspective, what problem is the most important problem to solve for? That may not be what the doctor thinks. That may very well be what the parent or the child thinks in many of these rare diseases. So that's one really important dimension. But in addition, we want people to feel confident and encouraged to participate in clinical trials. And in order for that to work for most people, you need to assure that the clinical trial is convenient, that they understand the purpose of it, that they can understand and participate in all of the management and the steps that are to come, and that they have a full understanding of exactly what they are going to experience, why, and what the risks and benefits might actually be. So until you really sit down and include patients or their advocates from the very beginning, even when you're thinking about an approach to a disease, all the way through the design of what trial you want to conduct, what medicines you're thinking of developing, through the clinical trial process, and all the way through the other side of it, when people need to have their voice represented, when the FDA is making decisions about approving a drug, and ultimately parents and advocates have to make decisions about whether or not they're going to take the drug once it's approved. So that lived experience is so critical in every aspect of medicine, but particularly in the rare disease dimension. And that's why at FNIH, we have now dedicated leaders who are focused on engaging patients across our entire end-to-end work. We're also bringing patients every month to our monthly all-hands meeting so that all of the employees of the FNIH hear the lived experience, and that helps them understand why our work is important. But it also motivates a sense of urgency and purpose that reminds people, yes, this is why I get up in the morning. This really matters. We have to do this right. We have to do this safely. We have to do this appropriately, and we have to do it expeditiously. So I can't say enough about how important that voice it really is. And, you know, Sharon's participating in this conversation in large part because she's one of the voices we listen to, and she has had a tremendous impact on how we designed the BCGT. So it's really an important part of the partnership.
Yes, I'd like to turn to you, Sharon, and talk about your perspective as a patient advocate and caregiver here. Your daughter, Taylor, was diagnosed with CLN1 disease, which falls under the umbrella of Batten disease. Can you tell us some more about CLN1 disease for people who may not be familiar with that condition?
Sure. Thanks so much. So CLN1 disease is part of a group of disorders that are known as the neuronal ceroid lipofuscinoses, or NCLs, and they're collectively referred to as Batten disease. All of these disorders affect the nervous system, and they're progressive. Progressive is a key word for me. Time is almost as much the enemy as the disease itself. The first signs of the disease for Taylor were unexpected, unexplained learning issues and vision loss. And once we had a diagnosis, and that took us a couple of years, which we actually were more on the more fortunate side to get a diagnosis that early. As the disease progressed, she suffered seizures. There was a movement disorder that resembled Parkinson's disease. And eventually, she lost her ability to walk, to talk, to swallow. It's just, CLN1 disease is just an incredibly cruel disease. And I knew from the moment we heard her diagnosis and heard that there was really nothing we could do, that I had to do something. I couldn't just sit and watch this happen to her without fighting for something that could possibly do more than just treat a symptom. But it was a tough road. It's been a tough road from that moment when we said, we have to do something. You know, having hope for her is action. Means we have to get busy. We've got to work hard.
Yeah. Can you tell us some more about Taylor? What was she like as a person?
You know, it was devastating to watch CLN1 disease happen to this sweet, energetic kid who just loved life. She loved to sing. She loved to dance. And she was the social butterfly that the rest of her family is not. She was also courageous. I say that about her so often. And that trait served her well as she navigated life with Batten disease. And I think there's a great story to help listeners understand about this bravery this young girl possessed. And it was through her participation in a program called Girls on the Run. It's a program for young girls that helps them develop confidence, life skills. They also train together to run a 5K. Taylor came home from school in fifth grade with the application, and I took one look at it, and all of my parenting skills just flew right out the window because I responded, "Oh, honey, I just don't think you can do this." And, you know, she was blind. She had started having seizures. She was developing the clumsiness that's a symptom of CLN1 disease. And, you know, the mom in me said, she's going to get hurt. She can't do this. But she stamped her foot and she informed me that, yes, she would. She intended to run with her friends. "Mom, I can do it." And, you know, she did. Not once, but twice. She completed 5Ks. The first one was on a cold December morning. She fell a number of times, but she got up and she kept going. She had a goal and she intended to get there. She ran her second 5K 5 months later, and she improved her time by 12 minutes. Batten disease was continuing to march on, but Taylor was marching against it, and she improved her time. How can you not fight for a child, for children, with that kind of bravery?
Thank you for sharing more of her life with us. And you've been a patient advocate on Taylor's behalf for a long time now. You're the co-founder of Taylor's Tale, which advocates for rare disease patients and your daughter's memory. You were instrumental in helping to get Taylor's Law passed in North Carolina. Can you tell us about some of the ways in which Taylor's legacy lives on?
Sure. You know, when Taylor's Tale began supporting the early stage development of an AAV gene therapy for CLN1 disease, we were working hard to increase awareness. You have to have that awareness to fundraise to support these therapies. But we were working hard to increase awareness of this condition and the impact of all rare diseases on society. Our tagline was, "Rare disease is a public health imperative." We were also advocating for beneficial policies at the federal level, but then realized that a lot of those policies trickle down to the states. And we were particularly interested in state-based education about the needs of those living with rare diseases. You know, we kept asking the question, how can a policymaker make the best decisions on behalf of our citizens without a firm foundation of understanding? So that question was what spurred the nation's first Rare Disease Advisory Council, or RDAC as they're called. And it's been modeled 26 times now across the country. Ours was established here in North Carolina in 2015, and we're proud every day that it's called Taylor's Law, because it was really her bravery, her courage, that gave people that sense of, we have to do this. We have to do this for Taylor, but for those like her and those who will follow. You know, I'm pragmatic, and I realized that we were up against a huge challenge in CLN1 disease. I also knew firsthand the struggles of getting the best clinical care for kids like Taylor. I live in a metropolitan area with excellent available medical care and lots of specialists here in this city. Still, we faced challenges with Taylor's cares. Doctors don't see CLN1 disease very often, thank goodness. But when they do, they need answers, as do the families. Taylor's Tale funded a project that produced two IRB-approved surveys, one for caregivers and another for clinicians. And that information informed a three-day meeting where we brought 14 clinicians from across literally the globe with the most experience in CLN1 disease together to discuss best practices for clinical care. And after the meeting, a paper was published in the Journal of Pediatric Neurology, a clinical care consensus for CLN1 disease. I hope the mountain of work that went in to creating that consensus has been beneficial for children like Taylor and those who care for them. And for me, you know, that's two of the legacies that Taylor has left for those who will follow her, including an AAV gene therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those types of initiatives are so important, not only for expanding knowledge about, you know, these types of small rare diseases, but also awareness as well. And often for rare diseases, that's coming from a grassroots perspective. You know, it's ground up, it's patients involved, it's parents involved, things like that. So what a great way to honor her memory. I also know on the horizon is a gene therapy clinical trial for children like Taylor. Can you tell us some more about that?
Sure. We were really excited, you know, when it was announced recently that a child with CLN1 disease was treated in an investigator-led one-patient study late last year. It was actually announced Rare Disease Day this year. Taylor's Tale began funding the initial studies for that gene therapy in 2013. We announced our support of that study on Rare Disease Day 2013. So it took how many years to hear that one child was treated? No doubt the King family celebrated, you know, celebrated that announcement. It meant the world to us. It was terrific, long time coming news. But we also know that one child is not enough. It was a one patient study. There are other children and families that need that same hope. And we also need to understand what this potential therapy can do and what it can teach us for later therapies. In some ways, the CLN1 disease AAV gene therapy program for the King family and for all of those people that worked through Taylor's Tale to move forward, you know, in hope of a treatment, a potential treatment like this, you know, we feel like it's a child that we gave birth to, and then we sent it off, you know, on to be nurtured and trained to go out and do good in the world to help kids like Taylor. Because after the initial studies were completed at UNC, the program was licensed to industry. But there have been so many stumbling blocks and hurdles to cross since that time. In some ways, the science seems to be the simpler part of moving forward a gene therapy, and we know it's not for a rare population. You know, there have been funding issues. The issues that were explained earlier in this conversation, trial design, the complexities of manufacturing, a regulatory path that's often more crooked than straight for these very rare populations. And it's difficult to make a business case for these small therapies. I've learned that many times over since we first began funding that initial study. And, you know, it's really difficult for me to say those words that we have to think about making a business case for these very small populations. I'm a mom, and I believe that no disease is too rare. And that's why I'm championing the work that's happening through the Bespoke Gene Therapy Consortium.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the BGTC regulatory playbook that we've been discussing today? What are some of the ways that you're hopeful that it will help rare disease patients?
You know, my story is not unique. There are so many families who've done exactly as we have done. They've gone out and said, I can't accept no hope, no cure. I've got to do something. We need to agree. What I think this regulatory playbook is doing, it's this playbook and then the iterations that will follow, is we're agreeing on an efficient process, standardization that makes sense for these small populations. You know, as I shared earlier, time is critical. It's almost as much the enemy. And we need a process that can move to the finish line more efficiently, more effectively. And the playbook will be this vetted and agreed upon process, both in its current form as we continue to get new additions to the playbook. And we have to work together. Well, that's one of the things I love about this program. It's together. Even patients are at the table to develop these processes, because families like mine are not going to give up. They're not going to accept no. They'll continue to ask, why not? And they're going to push hard for an answer. And thank goodness we have this team of, you know, this public-private partnership that's helping to drive forward what families need most. We need answers. We need treatments for these kids. We don't want to continue watching these devastating diseases alter not only the lives of children and, you know, patients, but families.
Yeah, I think that really underlines why this is so important. Well, I'd like to open up the floor then to everyone to discuss any final thoughts or perhaps some of your hopes for the future of gene therapy development.
Yeah, so Sharon has been referring to the future versions of the playbook, and absolutely, this is just the first of probably two or three editions that we expect to put out before the end of the BGTC in 2027. While this first version is primarily publicly accessible information, as we go through the process of our own clinical portfolio, our own manufacturing, our own preclinical testing, our own clinical trials and regulatory submissions, we really see that as a way to demonstrate the repeatability of some of these processes. And because we are a public-private partnership, solving challenges that neither the government or the private sector or the patient communities could do on their own, we have the ability to make almost everything that we put into the BGTC publicly available. So we expect that future editions of the regulatory playbook will build on the information that is already available, will include the sets of critical quality attributes and the preclinical testing protocols that have been pressure tested through our own journey with these eight rare diseases. We will be releasing regulatory documentation, our correspondence with the FDA, so that others who follow behind us in the process know what to expect at each step of the process, what types of information, how to structure it, how to get it to the right places. And so while we only have eight diseases in our clinical portfolio, we wouldn't really consider ourselves a success if we only had eight successful clinical trials, only successfully treated 50 or 60 patients across the portfolio. We really see this as a way to produce the resources that will enable not just those eight diseases in the portfolio, but potentially thousands of diseases, potentially millions of rare disease patients who have been waiting 11 years or more, Sharon, for those opportunities for hope to come forward. And if we can make that 11-year journey shorter, less uncertain, potentially even a little bit less expensive for families like Sharon's, that would be the success for the consortium.
And I'll just add to that, that these studies that are included in the first eight are all using the AAV vector that you discussed earlier, but science is on our side. And there are other vectors, other viral vectors and other non-viral vectors, and then other technologies like CRISPR. So the tools to address these rare diseases continue to expand, and we will continue to use those tools as they emerge in ways that we hope will be able to solve an even bigger subset of the rare disease challenge. So science definitely is on our side. Now we just have to get society and the system to support the investments and the progress that we know we will be able to make.
Hey, Sharon, is there anything you'd like to add for this question?
You know, when Taylor was diagnosed in 2006, since that time, I've had the privilege to have this view of this scientific evolution, which I think really is a revolution in medicine. And I think that science is taking us to places that at one time were considered impossible. I was told impossible on day one of diagnosis. I don't believe impossible. And I want to see this continue. I want to see us work together, as we are doing right now, to figure out the challenges that are wrapping around this science and holding it back from people like Taylor. I want to continue to address the other challenges, you know, diagnosis, reimbursement models that work, and these other complex issues that are going to help people who are suffering these disorders have another chance at life. And we can do this. I know we can. And it is a privilege every day to be a part of this BGTC, this Bespoke Gene Therapy Consortium, that really is focusing on bringing these, you know, potentially bringing these medicines to patients like Taylor sooner. And we need it desperately. And I'm just grateful every day that they are focused on getting this done, and they're going to do it.
Hey, well, if someone would like to learn more about Taylor's Tale or about the FNIH and the Gene Therapy Regulatory Playbook, what are the best places for them to do that?
So for the regulatory playbook, it is currently available online on the FNIH website. You can go to fnih.org/BGTC. You'll find the playbook. We also have resources for patients as well as resources for scientists. If you'd like to be the first to hear about new developments within the BGTC, we also have a newsletter that you can sign up for. And while that first version of the playbook is currently in a downloadable PDF, we hope that at some point in the future, we'll be able to digitize that, make it a little bit more of a living document on the web.
Okay. What about Taylor's Tale, Sharon? If someone would like to find out how they might get involved or what Taylor's Tale is doing to help rare disease patients, where can they find out more?
TaylorsTale.org or Sharon@TaylorsTale.org.
Okay. Short and sweet. All right. Well, Drs. Gerberding and Silverthorne, Sharon, thank you so much for taking the time today to come on the show and help tell your stories and the important work that's going on over at the FNIH. We really appreciate you sharing these exciting developments with our audience.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to help tell our story.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if you'd like to learn more about the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health, its work in the area of gene therapies, or more about Taylor's Tale and the way that organization is advocating for the rare disease community, we will leave links in the show notes of this episode so that you can check those resources out. And remember, you can always keep up with the latest in rare disease news by visiting our website at patientworthy.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and more by searching for PatientWorthy on those platforms. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and leaving us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. Subscribing ensures you'll automatically receive our new monthly episodes as soon as they come out, and a review or rating really does go a long way toward helping us out. Finally, if you have any questions about the podcast or perhaps an idea for a future episode, you can get in touch with me by sending an email to Colby, that's C-O-L-B-Y, at patientworthy.com. That does it for today's episode. Thank you once again to Dr. Julie Gerberding, Dr. Courtney Silverthorne, and Sharon King for joining me on the show today. And as always, thank you for listening.